From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Western North Carolina has been luring visitors to its mountains since the late 1800s. The region has been touted as a health sanctuary, a religious retreat, and a folksy cultural preserve. And all of that seems to have paid off. Tourism and second home industries are a big part of the regional economy. But rising real estate values and tensions between newcomers and natives raises the question, does tourism equal progress and opportunity, or does it really mean exploitation of land and the locals? Joining me to discuss the issues are Richard Starnes. Richard Starnes is a history professor at Western Carolina University, the author of Creating the Land of the Sky, Tourism and Society in Western North Carolina. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Frank. I'm a big fan of the show, and it's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here and talk about tourism, especially at this time, I guess, when folks are maybe making their vacation plans. I want to also invite our listeners to call in at 877-962-9862. You can send us an email at sot@wunc.org, and maybe they can help us answer the question, Richard, I'm going to put to you, which is, does tourism, I mean, is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? What kind of a blessing is it?
Well, I think it's too big a topic, really, to paint in black and white. I think that certainly tourism has some very positive effects on the local economy. It does provide jobs. It does provide a larger tax base in many rural communities. It does bring new people, new ideas to regions. But, of course, there is a negative side with regard to land use. There are pronounced environmental issues in many cases. The often touted criticism of tourism is that it brings in jobs, yes, but it also brings in typically low-paying jobs, and that undermines other aspects of the economy. In my book, I talk about how tourism defines the society of Western North Carolina, and I think that's true, but I think it's both a positive and a negative, and it really, in many ways, depends on which side of the fence you stand on.
Sure. Well, and those definitions have changed over time as well. I mean, there have been some interesting myths and images associated with tourism. Take us back a little bit to the dawn of the tourism age in that part of the country, and how the how that part of the world was viewed by tourists.
First, in the early 19th century, Western North Carolina was a haven for the planters. Many planters from South Carolina, Georgia, Eastern North Carolina would make annual migrations to mountain homes, second homes, in fact, I guess we would call them now, to escape what they call the fever season. Mm. The malarial areas of the low country of South Carolina and Georgia especially bred malaria, and they fled to the highlands in order to escape. And some places like Flat Rock and what would become Hendersonville and other areas like that became something of low country settlements during the summer months. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. In fact, Flat Rock had a label called the Charleston of the Mountains in the years before the Civil War. Some extremely prominent folks summered in Western North Carolina. Wade Hampton, the famous Confederate general in South Carolina, politician, mm-hmm. Had a home there now in the area now known as High Hampton. C.G. Memminger, the former Confederate cabinet official, lived in Western North Carolina during part of the summer. So it was a very elite, very much health-focused type of tourism. And once that took hold, other planters who maybe couldn't afford to have a second home there would come, and resorts sprang up. The Sulphur Springs Resort outside Asheville became very popular. In fact, they imported a free black orchestra from Columbia in order to cater to summer guests. So it becomes something of an elite tourism following the health phase. It becomes something of an elite tourism. And then after the Civil War, we see the emergence of health tourism again as a number of physicians and a number of quacks mm-hmm. cite the health benefits of living in the mountains.
Well, they came for the cure, but they stayed for the culture, I guess. And that's where some of the stereotypes build in, this kind of colorful mountain culture that caught on, but in many ways became inescapable for the people who lived up there.
Yes, in fact, there was a decision made, I hate to term it that way, but it really was a decision by prominent tourist entrepreneurs up in the mountains, Eden W. Grove, the proprietor of the Grove Park Inn, and others who decided to make a conscious effort to step away from health tourism in the late 19th and early 20th century and to focus more on elite tourism. tourism, building these large resort hotels, Grove purchased a number of tuberculosis sanitariums and burned them to the ground in order to rid the city of this, of Asheville particularly, of this image of being a place where you came to take the cure. And Grove and others were among the leaders in attempting to commodify mountain culture and sell it to tourists in the form of homespun cloth and in the form of music and other crafts.
And before we get to the impact of that, we should say in part this was due to the fact that the whole selling this thing on the basis of its healthy resort, the fact that it was a good place to come to get healthy, just wasn't true. People weren't getting better. They came there to die, mostly.
In fact, yeah, that's exactly true. And you see ads in newspapers where boarding houses or hotels are advertising for customers, and they'll say, no consumptives need apply, or no lungers. I think folks were conscious of the fact that it really didn't help you with your tuberculosis, and Grove and others saw the benefits of developing a more destination-based tourism.
So then you end up with clogging and other mountain quilts and that kind of thing, and that leads to some tension among the real native folks who know that these folks are coming up looking at them as some kind of colorful exotics rather than the real live people they are.
Absolutely. In 1928, the Asheville Chamber of Commerce came to a man named Bascom Lamar Lunsford, who music fans will maybe know for his efforts in documenting and preserving mountain ballads. They came to him. They said, we'd like to have some sort of a folk festival as part of a larger festival called the Rhododendron Festival, which was, it's sort of hard to describe. It had everything from a parade and a cotillion to a black baby contest. It's an interesting 1920s kind of phenomenon. And they asked him, will you develop this? And he said, absolutely. And Lunsford, being a native of Buncombe County and an attorney and one who had seen the forces of modernity erode mountain music, he said, yeah, this would be a great way to portray mountaineers in a different light. And so he developed this mountain dance and folk festival, and it became the most popular time of the festival itself. In fact, the Rhododendron Festival fades away, and the Mountain Dance and Folk Festival continues to this day. Lunsford himself had some interesting things to say about mountain culture. He didn't want for people to show up wearing their traditional dress, what they wore every day. In fact, he had people wear their Sunday best so as not to portray a bad image of mountaineers. He's also the man widely credited as developing the idea that all clogging teams should wear the same outfit as a way to make it more visually appealing.
This is the Berry Gordy of mountain culture, it seems.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, well, and so what effect has it had on preserving culture? I mean, on the one hand, I guess you can say, well, it may be tourism, may be responsible for it, but then the other part of that question is, well, preserving what culture?
Exactly. In many ways, the people who make the selection of what culture to preserve really dictate the terms of the debate. A good example of this is Biltmore Industries. Biltmore Industries develops as a way for the mountain traditional weaving practices to be continued. Edith Vanderbilt, George Vanderbilt's wife, plays a prominent role in developing Biltmore Industries, and she eventually sells it to Fred Seeley, who is E.W. Grove's son-in-law, and they move it to the Grove Park Inn, and you read these brochures talking about how great Biltmore Industries is and how you're watching the native mountaineers weave in ways that date back to Scotland and Ireland, when in fact most of the folks who were employed at Biltmore Industries had to be taught to weave in the first place. Mm.
And were they being taught traditional crafts, or were these crafts modified to really suit the taste of the elite tourists they were attracting?
They were taught traditional techniques, but the styles were clearly modified to fit the taste of the day and varied from year to year and decade to decade. As tastes in America changed, so did the portrayal of mountain crafts.
So I guess that means people were hired, which leads to the question about wage labor and whether or not this is a good thing for the economy.
Looking back historically, I think we can say that tourism workers were clearly paid less historically than other professions. I got some examples in my book where I compare the wages of mill workers in North Carolina. Mill workers, of course, were never noted for their high wages nor good working conditions. And I can't quote the figure, but the average mill worker in 1949 made, I think, something like $0.90 an hour or something to that effect, and tourism workers were paid 52% less.
Mm. Well, and if we talk about cultural exploitation and changes, I guess we know that there's a Cherokee Indian population up there. Certainly was a larger one, but there is still a small population. Tell us a bit about how that culture has changed and was affected by tourism.
Well, actually, people view tourism in Cherokee as sort of a 20th century phenomenon. In fact, visitors were coming to the Cherokee Indian Reservation as early as the 1880s. David Schenck, a very important North Carolina politician of the 19th century, wrote in his journal that he had gone to Cherokee in order to buy baskets from the native Cherokee, and apparently there was something of a trade there, and many of the early resort hotels in the late 19th century, 1880s, 1890s, of Cherokee baskets were offered for sale. By about the time the Great Smoky Mountains National Park begins to be formed in the 1930s, you see Cherokee emerge as more of the attraction we would see it today, not without the glitter and the glitz of what you see in Cherokee now, but you begin to see it emerge as a destination. And Cherokees make a conscious decision to play on their unique role in American culture. The image of the Native American as portrayed in countless Western films, it really captures the American imagination. And so you see Cherokee men particularly begin to dress up in Plains Indians costumes and begin what they call chiefing.
Right, not their native costume at all. So we're talking on the state of things today about tourism of the mountains of North Carolina, and Western Carolina professor Richard Starnes is with us today, the author of Creating the Land of the Sky, Tourism and Society in Western North Carolina. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Just ahead, we'll hear about putting a price on the view and the Tweetsie Railroad. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcast from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking today about the cultural and social implications of tourism in Western North Carolina with Richard Starnes, a professor of history at Western Carolina University. And we're talking today again about tourism in that part of the state, which doesn't, Richard, just affect local businesses. It has lots of social implications. Asheville, we just got a write-up in the New York Times. It was not quite so hip and trendy 20 years ago. How has that change taken place?
It has taken place, I think, mostly because we see a new phase of tourism begin to develop. The rhythm of tourism development seems to go elite tourism and then a different type and then back to elite. And I think that's what we see happening in Asheville. As Asheville becomes more chic, it's really, I think, based on this kind of wave in the tourism development process. An interesting thing to note is Asheville has always maintained this self-image as being a very progressive, very much different than other southern cities. That's a self-perception, and it's something that they capitalized on as early as the 1890s. And now you see Asheville as becoming a haven for folks who are maybe left out of other tourist destinations. You see the theme of elite white upper middle class, upper class tourism there too, but you see things like a more progressive strain in Asheville culture. Asheville's got a very strong reputation as being a city that's friendly for gays and lesbians, and that's clearly a change and something different than other southern cities, and it's really the manifestation of this over a century long idea that Asheville is distinctive, that it's different, that it's progressive.
And yet somehow reflective of the area as well. Leah Matthews joins us now by phone. She's an associate professor of economics at the University of North Carolina at Asheville and studies ways to price things that aren't exchanged in markets. Leah, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And tell us a little bit more. We're talking with, about this business of Asheville as distinct from and yet a part of mountain culture. Is that something that you sense about the way Asheville sort of markets itself?
Certainly. And I'm not, a marketing type per se, but it's very clear that Asheville is kind of a hub of the regional tourist economy. And so it is seen as kind of a leader in terms of the draw, both for cultural reasons and for the natural resource and environmental amenities that surround the city.
Well, what you've been doing is trying to put a price on things that we find difficult to price, and that's things like the view, and that gets to questions of how we choose to use the land. Tell us about the ways of measuring this kind of thing. Not just the tourism. We can measure the number of, you know, we can count dollars into hotels and restaurants and gift shops. But when it comes to putting a price tag on a view, how do you go about measuring that?
Well, very carefully is the short answer. The reality of doing this kind of work is that it takes a very deliberate, concerted effort in order to get reliable numbers. But really what we're trying to do is just ask people about the trade-offs that they would be willing to make if, say, they lost the views. So, for example, in a study that we completed a couple of years ago, we asked visitors to the Blue Ridge Parkway about their values for preserving the scenic beauty along the park. And one of the ways that we did that was asking them about how much they would be willing to pay, basically to trade off in terms of other goods and services in order to have the views preserved. And interestingly, you know, people love the park. They love the scenic beauty in Western North Carolina, and they are willing to pay.
But how is this translated in terms of their ability to pay to preserve the view? Because the money, it seems to me, doesn't go to the folks who have an interest in perhaps changing that land use.
Well, and that's the real struggle here. And clearly, that's one of the reasons why people like me are interested in talking about the kind of work that I do. Because the best that I can do as a researcher is find out what people say they would be willing to pay to preserve the landscapes. But to actually make it happen in terms of getting those dollars funneled into, say, a land protection fund or a fund that would help to reinvest in view sheds is another matter entirely. And that really takes a lot of responsibility by local governments to make decisions about those kinds of policies.
Richard Starnes, maybe this is the first time we've done this kind of research into the question, but that question has been at the heart of one of the controversies up in that part of the world since the beginning of tourism, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. In fact, the whole idea of development is curious. One of the criticisms of the tourism industry is that it undermines other forms of economic development. You see, if you read newspapers from Asheville and Waynesville and some of the other towns in the region in the late 19th century, you see editors taking a conscious position away from things like industrial development in order to maintain the region as a tourist destination. They realized early on that what brings people to Western North Carolina is the place, the landscape, and they realized that early on. You see that when the Great Smoky Mountains National Park is being debated and Champion Fiber comes out very much opposed, Champion Fiber being one of the largest employers in the region during that time, a paper manufacturer, and they said, you know, well, we can't have this park. It'll take away the trees. We need to make paper. And many editors said, look, we've got to maintain the basis of our economy, and that's tourism. That means maintaining the land. It's curious how the debate has changed in the 20th century.
Does the debate continue, or does tourism win out once and for all, and you decide, no, there's no other industrial use that's ever going to trump tourism for a place this beautiful?
Well, I think that tourism wins out to a degree, and then tourism becomes something of the problem. You began to see in the 1970s and 1980s the construction of homes, particularly resort hotels in places like Boone and Asheville and other places that actually ruined the landscape in the eyes of many. And so there was a push to have ridgetop construction regulated, and a law was passed in the state legislature in the 1980s to regulate the height of buildings on top of ridgetops in order to make this to continue to have the land. But the people who were building those homes were second homeowners who originally came to the region as tourists, and the people who were building the hotels were resort developers who were attempting to capitalize on the tourism industry.
Leo Matthews, do you get the sense that your research is actually is feeding into the policy debate, and this debate now can maybe take place from a more informed point of view?
Well, I would sure like to think that's true. And that's, quite frankly, why we do this kind of work, because it's really easy to count jobs and tax revenue that comes in from a manufacturing plant, but it's not as easy to count those dollars that come in from being able to gaze at a beautiful scenic view. So if we can have a way of putting a price on those intangibles, then I think we can have a more informed debate, and we can really think more carefully about the opportunity cost, that is the lost opportunities that will happen if we have, for example, more of the urbanization of the mountainsides that we're seeing around Asheville.
Still, I'm curious how the debate or how the information itself and how the data helps to settle the argument in the sense that, if I'm a native and I live there and I've owned this land forever, I really stand to benefit by cashing out. So your research just tells me something that I've known for a long time. If I sell this land to a developer, I make a lot of money.
That's right. That's right. And that is ultimately the real challenge that our communities in the western part of the state face. We have a very long-standing, strong tradition of private property rights, and I don't think anybody's saying that people shouldn't be able to do what they wish with their land. But having information about the impacts of some of these developments on the community will help raise awareness, I think, about the fact that it's not just impacting individuals in terms of, say, the retirement income that I get from being able to sell my farm for a residential development. But it is, in fact, my decision to do that will, in fact, influence my community. It will influence the tax dollars that the county can bring in. And so I would like to think that we would all have a better sense of the full set of implications of those decisions.
Tell us a little about your cultural heritage study.
Well, cultural heritage is just one piece of a current project that I'm working on, which does look at the value of farmland in four counties in western North Carolina. We will be going into the field this summer asking people basically what kinds of things they value about farmland in Buncombe, Haywood, Henderson, and Madison counties. And we imagine that what people will tell us is that there's an important story that we want to be able to preserve about the heritage of farming in western North Carolina in terms of its impact on our local mountain cultures. And so it's pretty early on in the project yet. I can't tell you much more than that because I'm not sure what folks will tell us. But certainly ways of thinking about farmland that include visual amenities, flood control, cultural heritage, all these things that aren't, again, typically priced in those decisions about how we use farmland.
Well, we certainly can't talk about cultural heritage in western North Carolina without talking about the Tweetsie Railroad, which has been entertaining North Carolina families since 1957.
That's right.
Calls me to a better place and time, and you get there on the Tweetsie Railroad line.
Well, that brings back memories, but that family-owned theme park may not be around much longer. Chris Robbins is on the line with us now to explain the situation. Chris is Executive Vice President and General Manager of Tweetsie Railroad. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Nice to be on the show.
And we are taking your calls at 877-962-9862. If you have any memories of the Tweetsie or, parking and camping and vacationing in western North Carolina, give us a call at 877-962-9862. Your business has felt the impact of the real estate appreciation. What's the Tweetsie's current lease situation?
Well, Tweetsie, when it was created in 1957, was built largely on leased land. It was a 50-year lease, and before you know it, 50 years have gone by, and leases expire at the end of 2007, and the land that we're leasing has gone up tremendously in value, and don't know if we can afford to continue doing the same thing we've been doing with it.
So you're worried about the future of the park?
Absolutely.
Can the park operate at a profit if the leases are renewed?
Yes, up to a point. A lot of our leases, the rental rates are tied to the appraised land value, and land prices in Watauga County in the Boone Blowing Rock area are doubling every 5 years or even outpacing that. So if we're facing 100% rent increases every 5 years, I don't know if we can keep up with that by operating an attraction like Tweetsie Railroad on this land.
Now, for you and your family, it seems that it wouldn't be a financial hardship if you did have to sell. You're leasing the land, though.
Leasing a portion of land. Part of it we own, part of it we lease.
So that part that you sell, I would suspect that you would be able to do pretty well on.
Well, that's the other side of the coin. Yeah, it's gone up tremendously in value also.
Has there been community interest in saving the Tweetsie?
Absolutely, but there's only so much a community can do. We have a huge fan base out there and generations of satisfied customers at Tweetsie who would really hate to see it go away, but there's only so much you can do in the face of this kind of market pressure.
Leah Matthews, is this the kind of research and the kind of cultural heritage that folks think about preserving and would invest in to try to preserve?
It certainly can be. You know, all around the country, we see movements to try to preserve not only physical places like open spaces, but attractions and features, and even, you know, working farms. So, sure, I mean, it's definitely possible, and I think what would really need to happen to make that a reality is to get a really good sense of that heritage of generations of visitors and what it is they value about it and how much.
Chris, what's the next milepost or deadline in your effort now to keep the Tweetsie going?
Well, we're trying to find a situation that might resolve our lease situation, and we're looking at relocating the park to other locations in northwestern North Carolina. And to talk to, I guess, Professor Starnes' comments earlier, tourism economies are something that some places are seeking now that the counties around us have lost tremendous jobs because of textile plant closings, furniture plant closings. Conventional manufacturing has gone away and not coming back. They're really interested in creating a tourism economy now and get some people reemployed. So they're very interested in having Tweetsie Railroad relocated to those areas.
All right. Well, Chris, good luck, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Chris Robbins is Executive Vice President, General Manager of the Tweetsie Railroad near Boone. You know, Richard Starnes, it raises the question, though, about, again, which cultural heritages we preserve and how native they are. If you think about something like the Tweetsie, which is something, again, it's a sort of an industrial cultural icon in the area. Let's take a look at another controversy now, the Speedway controversy in Asheville in the 1990s. Talk a little bit about that. And again, here's an effort by local folks to preserve something they consider a cultural icon. But, you know, it's a speedway, which is not something we associate with the mountains.
Right, and that's really an interesting kind of dynamic as it unfolded in Asheville when the Asheville Motor Speedway was put up for sale because it was not turning a profit. Thousands of people came out in support of keeping the speedway there and prevent it from being redeveloped. And what ended up happening was a local community organization called Riverlink, which works to preserve the landscape along the French Broad River, ended up purchasing this speedway and turned it in ultimately to a park. The real issue became who's actually behind the money that Riverlink used to purchase the speedway. About that same time, the Biltmore Estate was building a large resort hotel on the grounds of the Biltmore Estate itself, which the plans for that date back to George Vanderbilt and the early 20th century, but that's neither here nor there. They were building this hotel. It's right across the river from the speedway, and of course you can hear the cars as they go around and around on the speedway from the hotel site. So locals were convinced that the Biltmore Estate was behind this huge, I forget the exact amount, it was well over $1 million to purchase the motor speedway. In fact, they were not the anonymous donor, as it was called in the paper, but the fact that everybody in Asheville believed that they were says something about the tensions between locals and tourist developers.
And the land hasn't been developed.
It is not. It's actually, I think, owned by Riverlink now, and it is a park. They're using the speedway for a bicycle track.
And the Tweetsie Railroad is an interesting situation in itself in that the Tweetsie didn't try to cash in on mountain stereotypes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's curious. They take more of a Western theme, and that's a theme in Western North Carolina tourism. There are at least two other attractions that I remember from my childhood going to. I went to Tweetsie. That was a good time too. But there were others: Ghost Town in the Sky in Maggie Valley, and Frontierland in Cherokee. Also capitalized on these Wild West themes. I think that when they were developed, the Wild West was a prominent theme in American culture, and so the attempt was to appeal to middle class tourists by giving them something that they could relate to, something they were interested in, and give them a good time. And so there were several places like that in the mountains that did exactly the same thing. Silver Dollar City and Pigeon Forge just across the mountain.
As you watch these trends evolve and change over time, what do you see as the next big trend and the next big conflict, I suppose, in that region over how to use the land?
I see two, really. One is the move more to destination-based tourism. And you see that, I think, best with the development of Harris Cherokee Casino on the Cherokee Indian Reservation. when it opened, there was a lot of controversy as to whether or not this would work in this setting in the larger regional tourist economy. And now, based on the information that I'm seeing, Harrah's is the largest man-made attraction in the state of North Carolina and one of the largest in the Southeast, growing, if you count it by the turnstile, by people through the door. So that's
a gambling casino up in the mountains. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an important thing. I think the real tension we're going to see over land use is the one we've been talking about, and that is the issue of redevelopment. What effect will increased tourism development, particularly in the realm of second homes, have on the larger tourist economy and on the environment of the mountains itself? If you read some of the environmental studies, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park on bad days has air as bad as it is in Los Angeles. So there are pronounced environmental impacts.
Richard, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Richard Starnes is author of Creating the Land of the Sky, Tourism and Society in Western North Carolina. And Leah Matthews, thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Leah is an associate professor of economics at the University of North Carolina at Asheville. We've given you some food for thought as you head off into the mountains this weekend. We want to thank Chris Robbins as well, executive vice president of the Tweetsie Railroad, for being with us. Just ahead, Raleigh-based singer-songwriter Kenny Roby says he's just as much a punker as a roots rocker, and he'll prove it by playing live from his latest release, The Mercy Filter. Stay with us.